Devices Radio Network.
It's not just a 20 rep set. It's a 20 rep set to the death.
Yes. So to the views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for entertainment and educational purposes only.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger. Faster.
Welcome to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson, Jordan Peters, and Scott McNally, part of the Advices Radio Network, a new voice in bodybuilding podcasting.
Welcome back to Muscle Minds. I'm Scott McNally, and with me, as always, the most muscular mind I know, and seriously, a guy that has dedicated his life to understanding the science and the art of muscle, Dr. Scott Stevenson. What's up, brother? How you been?
That was nice. That just rolled, man. It's almost like I wrote that for you or something. Check is in the mail, baby.
Cha-ching.
That was good. Thanks, man. Yeah. I'm good. It's been kind of chilly here for Florida. I'm not going to complain because I know weather has been pretty crappy elsewhere, at least in the States. But it's a nice sunny day. So another, shorts and t-shirt day on the Gulf Coast of Florida.
Nice. How's everything coming along with the seminar that you and John Meadows are doing on Thursday before the Arnold?
I'm pretty happy. We're getting more and more people are trickling in.
Nice.
Which I was concerned wouldn't happen because, finding a hotel there is really, really tough.
Yeah.
I think maybe finding a hotel for Wednesday night is probably not that bad. But if someone, for instance, had already planned on coming and then they're like, oh, geez, I want to go to that.
Yeah.
They'd have to in worst case scenario, of course, pay the extra cost for changing their flight, maybe, depending on, what the rules and regulations were when they bought it. But then they have to maybe find another hotel to stay in. So stay one hotel on Wednesday night and then shift to their regular one. So I was thinking that, we had sort of a small window to get people who hadn't finalized their plans to sign up. But the people have been signing up still.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah. I had one someone who bought 6 tickets, which I was really stoked about.
Wow.
That's cool. Yeah, I know who it is, but I won't, say who it was. He probably wouldn't care, but
We will see him there and 5 of his friends, right?
yeah, exactly. And a few people have bought a couple tickets too, some couples and someone coming with a person's father, and that's pretty cool. So it's going to be badass.
Nice. I decided I'm going to make it no matter what it takes. I'm going to come down early.
Sweet.
So yeah, I'm definitely going to go.
Okay, cool.
And speaking of which, I have to finalize some arrangements. I usually don't stay right downtown. In fact, I never have. I've always stayed in like a surrounding town and, driven, the 20 minutes or whatever to get into the area. And then that way I kind of like that because then, nighttime comes and I don't go to parties and stuff. So I'll go to Applebee's or, whatever, get a burger and I'll be in some town that's like 25 minutes away and there's nothing bodybuilding going on there, which it's kind of like a break from the chaos of the day for me. So that
I hear you. Yeah. Sometimes it can be cool, but like after a few days, like if you come out of just like you want to go get some ice in your hotel room.
Yeah.
And there's just the hotels filled with bodybuilders and people that you you've got to put the off switch because you've been talking for 12 hours straight.
Exactly.
And now you just like want to stop.
Right.
And you run into someone's like, oh shit, you haven't seen it. So you can't help yourself. You start talking again.
Right.
I think you're like me again. And so you drain yourself, because you're constantly in the soup. You need to get out of the pool and dry off.
Yeah.
You know, every once in a while.
And that's why, like, every single person I know ends up sick after the Arnold. Like, if you notice how many people are sick, like, you know, the following week, everybody catches something. In fact, I think, were you sick last year?
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't, it's a good possibility. I may have gotten sick. Yeah. I don't really attach my, I don't really remember when I was sick or not, unless I learned something from it.
Yeah. Okay.
It may have been me. It's like the perfect environment for spreading germs.
Absolutely.
You know? It's cold outside. Everyone wants to huddle inside. People are coughing. It's so packed in there.
Yeah.
And your immune system gets, you know, totally screwed up because of the stress of walking around and everything.
I know Mike with Best Bar Ever is going to be there.
Yes. Yeah. He's providing some bars as part of the seminar for people that are there.
And he's
keep everyone afloat.
He's going to have a booth at the Arnold too, so that'll be cool.
Yep.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. I'm probably going to be hanging out over there for part of the expo.
Are you doing Advices Radio podcast there?
No, it's too loud. It's too loud. So we were going to plan a meetup, like a Bodybuilding Nerds meetup, probably Saturday morning.
Oh, and sweet.
That's kind of the idea. It's what we did last year at the Jantana booth. This year, if Mike's going to be there, though, I'd much rather go and support, you know, Best Bar Ever and try to bring a couple more people over there. Uh-huh. So, and I talked to him a little bit about it, but we haven't finalized any plans. But ideally, what I'd like to do is meet up before prejudging and, you know, like maybe an hour before. And then last time, a bunch of us walked over to prejudging right after that. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah, there is. I know there's technology for finding people.
Yeah.
You know, there was something because I picked up an Apple Watch to try to get some more insight into my sleep and heart rate variability. And I knew this was available on iPhones, but you can like make yourself actually you can set it up for just a certain period of time that you could make yourself your location be known to other people.
Oh, really?
Facebook, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I can't remember the details. I was just messing around with all the little apps on the Apple Watch, and I did that. I didn't know what it looks like. I didn't even follow up with the person. I told, you know, that I was going to be around to see if the person saw the you know, got the notification. But I think there's got to be something you can do with like Facebook, or maybe, you know, if you start that, I'm sort of just brainstorming here, but
yeah.
You want to have that meeting, it would be kind of cool to set the time and place, and then, like, you know, create like a group for it or a private message group, and then you can just say, okay, we're here, you know, or here's where we are or whatever we're doing, and that way people get reminders, you know. You can kind of make sure that everyone stays connected on their phone.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'd kind of thought of, like, what I did last year was I just made a post on my wall. Uh-huh. To say, hey guys, you know, it's Saturday morning, we're going to do this meetup in 2 hours type thing, you know,
and right.
Directed people where to go. But I think you've got even like more technology going on there.
There's all sorts of cool stuff for like finding people. And then there's that, I know I can't remember the name of them. They're kind of like, they're like dating apps. I think the first one, I believe, and I can't remember what the name of it is. I keep on forgetting the name.
Was
of
it the gay, app?
Yeah.
Grindr.
That was it. Yes, exactly. Yep. Yeah, so I think that
we'll have everybody get Grindr.
Yeah, there you go. That'd be nice, right? Yeah. And next thing you know, you're going to be standing there, you got two guys grinding on you, and you're like, oh, shit, this was a mistake. Whoops. Shouldn't have done that.
Oh, man.
But yeah, that whatever they're used for that, so you can locate people, so, you know, maybe there's something along those lines to connect everyone.
It's a good idea. Hey, speaking of technology and speaking of Apple Watches, we've had guests on, you know, on and off for the past few episodes. I haven't really gotten an update on your sleep situation. What's going on with that?
It's been interesting. I'm kind of a techno. I like technology just because I'm kind of a little bit of a geek. But I also, you know, I really have to want to stay cognizant of the extent to which it can kind of hijack my consciousness. You know,
sure.
That social media is not having a great effect on the way in which people interact with one another, I don't think. And
I agree.
In person. So that's, you know, we talked about that before, I think. But anyway, so yeah, I picked up an Apple Watch. So I got this Fitbit, and was using that to get sleep information. And the Apple Watch, there's an app called Pillow on there, which is the first one I've been playing with. Hmm. It breaks your sleep down into awake or active time, light sleep, deep sleep, and REM.
Okay.
Same as the Fitbit. So like, this is a nice comparison. And basically, the two don't match.
Really? So,
yeah, they don't really match very well at all.
That's not promising.
No, it's not. There's a couple places where the two devices don't seem to match for me. So you probably, like, if you look on, like anything I put on Instagram out, you'll probably see me wearing two watches, one on each arm.
Okay.
So like, as far as sleep goes, if I have a night, and this happened every single time, I believe, if I have a night, for instance, and these numbers aren't very impressive, the sleep was still pretty poor, but if I have a night where I have, let's say an hour of REM and 10 minutes of deep sleep on the Fitbit. So there's a kind of a pretty large ratio of one to the other. The ratio will be inverted on the other. I'll have like a lot of deep sleep and very little REM on the Apple Watch, or vice versa.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. So those heart rates are when you're at low heart rate. So it's using, what's called photoplethysmography. It's just how both the watches work, I believe, is they basically shine a light. You can see if you take one of these watches off your hand, that the Fitbit too, the light just stays on.
Okay.
And it just shines a light, and then it has a photo sensor, and the reflected light will change colors. Basically, the frequency or wavelength of the light changes.
Yeah.
Based on the oxygenation of the blood.
It's amazing they can do that. That technology is crazy. Yeah,
it's pretty cool, but it doesn't work that well. At least the one device versus the other. So I've been wearing these when I train, and when I go to, like when I'm doing, you know, heavy sets, large muscle mass stuff, the Fitbit, it's done weird things. Like once it told me I had a heart rate of 203, as a peak heart rate during, a workout, and which of course is highly unlikely, because that's 30 beats above what my max heart rate would be if using the standard estimation equation. So that's pretty improbable. And then the Apple Watch, when I do, you know, big stuff with legs or back or whatever, it just loses my heart rate.
Really?
Yeah. I'll look. There are times I'll check both watches. Once I sort of like, you know, come to, I'll click on both watches and I'll see like 143 on the Fitbit and like 65 on the Apple Watch.
Wow, that's such a huge difference.
Or it's out. It'll have a grayed out 65, and then like a sort of a spinning heart icon, which is telling me it can't pick up my heartbeat.
Hmm.
Yeah. So
that's kind of frustrating.
They're pretty expensive.
Yeah.
I did turn the Apple Watch around, so I was basically wearing the watch on the flexor surface, you know, on the underside of my arm.
And which seems like that would collect more data there.
My guess is that maybe because of the vascularity, I've got a bunch of veins there, that might be creating just thickness. And plus, if like I'm squeezing stuff, and there's pooling in those veins, and you know, it depends on what exercise I'm doing. You know, there can be some sort of bizarre, because you've got the arterial flow and the venous flow coming back, and things are too. It's just too much for it to sort of pick out what it needs to in order to actually determine a heart rate. Just because I've got more vessels there than maybe your average person does.
That makes sense.
I've got some big kind of bulging veins there on my forearm or on my wrist.
You're just bragging now.
I'm like, Jesus, it sucks, you know. It's right there, you can tell.
Yeah.
But then here's more bragging. This is not really anything to brag about, but so as far as the sleep goes, this all kind of fits together. It makes me wonder, there's so many potential sources of error, I don't know what the hell's going on. So I got a CPAP. This is all just sort of, it's all fascinating to me. I'm not complaining about this. It's kind of like I'm not dying, and I don't have too much sense that, you know, I'm going to, but it's kind of getting to where I need to fix this because I'm surviving. But so my CPAP, I've noticed in the last month or so, will just cut out just for a few seconds. I'll be sort of when I'm waking up in the morning, and I'll have the mask on, and all of a sudden I'll notice, like, hey, my CPAP's not on, but my ceiling fan's still working. I'm not losing electricity. I don't come back and find my computer's, you know, restarted itself because we lost power, and the CPAP just turns off, and I can't access the clinical menu on the CPAP to get a apnea hypopnea index, which normally would give me an index of an idea of, you know, how well I'm sleeping, how much apnea or hypopnea I'm having. So my CPAP isn't working all that well. I've got another one coming.
Okay.
That's a whole other side story. I'll just spare people on. But I got another one coming. So I'm buying a brand new one. It was time.
Okay.
But I got notification like 4 or 5 days ago, and I got one a couple of days ago. The Apple Watch tells me that my heart rate was above 120 around 4 a.m.
What?
Actually, I got like three of them between like 3:30 and 4.
That's frightening. So
that's not good.
No,
that's not good. So that, yeah, that doesn't suggest restful sleep in any way. It tells me I'm, you know, probably having some apnea. So, and
right there too. I mean, obviously it's terrible for your heart, but from a bodybuilding standpoint, you know, somebody who's trying to, say, gain muscle at the time, and then they're basically doing slow, steady state cardio all night long, you know, you're not going to be able to grow nearly as well, you know, if you've got your heart rate up like that, you know, half the night.
Oh, it's worse than steady state cardio, I think, for...
Oh, yeah. Well, for your heart, but I just mean, you know, as far as basically impeding gains, it's just going to not help. It's like doing cardio all night.
Yeah, but the stress hormone levels, I mean, I don't know. I need to go and look at my... Because I have all my original sleep study.
Okay.
All the printouts. I've got, you know, about 12 or 15 pages of stuff. And I think I even have like a condensed heart rate. So I like to go and look and see. I need to dig that out.
Okay.
And see, you know, how high my heart rate went during that sleep test. Because what they do, the sleep study, they force you to lie supine on your back.
Right.
And try to go to sleep. And it's just horrible because, you know, anyone who has obstructive apnea, or probably most people, like, they have this common thing that you start to like fall asleep, and then you start to kind of sort of, it feels like you're choking a little bit, but you get the apnea, you can't breathe.
Yeah.
But your glottis closes over your windpipe, and you're not breathing. So you kind of like, you're falling off to sleep, and then you wake up. You catch yourself, you kind of wake up, and it's like this really awful feeling. It's like someone came up behind you. I had no idea they're there, and just scared the bejesus out of you.
Yeah,
it's like this awful feeling. So your heart rate goes up. So but I'm not waking up at night, you know, with that sense of that having happened to me. But I wonder how high my heart rate got during that sleep study.
Yeah,
and to see if it got above 120, or it could just be the Apple Watch doesn't know what the hell's going on, because you know, that's the thing. It's like, maybe, who knows?
Right.
So yeah, I both my devices, my CPAP and my Apple Watch, and maybe even the Fitbit, I don't have any confidence in any of them being accurate measures of anything, really. So I'm hoping this I'm gonna like get this new CPAP going, and I'll just feel awesome.
I'm pumped for that, man. I kind of feel like I could use a new CPAP.
Yeah,
it's something's just not working right with it. Really, what I could do is just get it tuned, but I don't have good insurance anymore, and I don't know how to do it myself. It's all, you know, it's all computerized now. But
this is free information, so I can, you know, I'll just make this available. I'm not suggesting anyone do this, but
okay.
So you know, a lot of times you get prescribed a pressure. Mm-hmm. And this varies depending on who the prescribing physician or PA or I think nurse practitioners maybe can even prescribe CPAPs, some states. And that would be a constant pressure that matches what your sleep study suggested is appropriate.
Yeah.
Breathe properly. But like what I have is an auto set model made by ResMed, and that's what I've got coming. And this one works within a range of pressures, and it has sensor technology in there that figures out what you need.
Okay.
Which is exactly what I, you know, I knew enough way back when I talked to the PA, and I, you know, I came and I said, here's my symptoms of apnea. And he didn't believe me, until he finally looked at my trachea, and he said, oh, okay, you may have a problem, because I apparently have a really small windpipe. Okay. So that's, you know, something I wasn't able to figure out, but I said, my weight's going to change a lot. know, at that time I was, my weight was varying, you know, a good 30 or 40 pounds. And so the apnea is not all that, it's pretty bad at high body weights. And then there was once actually, well, 3 or 4 years ago, I think at the Masters Nationals, I actually fell asleep the night of the show without my CPAP on, and I slept through the night.
I remember you saying that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it was awesome. I was like, I was really, really disoriented, but it worked. So the extent, the pressure that I need varies depending on body weight. That's, you know, amount of water and the tissue and you know, so when the glottis, if you're like really waterlogged, you know, your glottis is going to be bigger and you're going to have, be more likely to block the airflow. So, I can't say, but it wouldn't be surprising to me as your weight is changing, you know, off season versus pre-contest. There's all sorts of things too that could affect this as well. Just your diet, how much salt in your diet, how much water you'll, just from that. You know, a lot of guys are talking about using growth hormone. That, of course, causes water retention depending on which kind you used and your predisposition for that.
Right.
You know, there's even, you know, the thought of, you know, heard banter back and forth. It makes sense. Obviously, you know, growth hormone causes cartilage growth. Mm. Preferentially increases connective tissue protein synthesis, and you get cartilage growth. You know, your feet and hands grow bigger, you know, nose and ears. If you look at people who tend to respond really well to growth hormone in terms of fat loss, those people tend to be the ones. This is like a pure, like, you know, across the board observation that I've just sort of noticed, and some other people I know have as well who have been around for a while, is that those are the folks who will have the more like nose and ear growth, that kind of stuff. So if you've got a lot of connective tissue in your throat, in the glottis, in the trachea, all of that whole airway is basically constructed of connective tissue. So if you're getting thickening there, you could be, you know, even narrowing and narrowing the airway and increasing the possibility of an obstructive apnea.
Yeah, that makes sense.
If you're for someone using growth hormone, just from the water retention, not to mention the long-term effects on cartilaginous growth. I've never seen that studied. You know, I looked before, and maybe there's something out there of people with acromegaly. You know, if they have an increased, you know, tendency for apnea, they don't have a very long life expectancy at all.
Right.
You know, how apnea is connected with that. You know, I think those folks are passed on by the time they're 40 in most cases. But so anyway, all those things vary. You know, it's much more in someone who's bodybuilding. Like, we're intentionally trying to, you know, change our body composition and doing things that change the tissue turnover. So having an auto set, you know, that sort of variable type setting makes sense, because your pressure is not going to be the same all the time. It's going to be all over the place.
Yeah, mine is variable pressure, but it's a set program. So it starts low and then it builds through the night. And what I found is that because I'm not as heavy as I have been, you know, in the depths of the off season or when I've let myself go a little, I don't need as much pressure. So it starts out okay. And then the middle of the night, I end up pulling it off because it's like blowing in my face, basically. It's too much.
Yeah. Oh, so it's variable, but it's not regulating.
Right, right. It's just on a fixed, you know, scale. Where it starts at 5 and it builds to 15, basically.
So it's not sensing what you need. That's a totally different, like, that's just sort of silly. That's like, it's like going to the gym and, like, we're going to do, you know, sets of 10 with 135, 2.25, 315, 405, and you get buried for 3 reps with 315. You don't put 4 or 5 in the bar.
Right.
You know, like, okay, that's need to make some adjustments here. That's just ridiculous. So maybe, I don't know, you know, maybe your machine's not capable of this, but maybe you could talk to your doc and see.
Yeah, I should. It's one of the newer ones. You know, I got it in the last few years, and it's by ResMed. And it says it's ResMed AirSense.
So, AirSense, is it say auto set after that?
You know what? I'm not sure. I'd have to run over to the bedroom and take a look at it. But okay. I'll talk to you afterward. See if maybe it's similar to what you have or what you're getting.
Yeah, when you can look on YouTube and find, you know, there are ways to access the clinical menu.
Okay.
Yeah, and you can. That's how I get the AHI off of mine. And you can change some of those settings. You're not legally supposed to do it, but I don't know exactly where it is. It's all over the YouTube. And, you know, you just Google, like, you know, can I change the settings on my CPAP? And it's like for every model, someone's
published
to do it. You know, so it's out there.
Nice.
Not suggesting anyone do it. You know, the interesting thing is, like, really, like, with this tachycardia at night I've been having and thing else, I contacted the folks I bought my CPAP from, and they're, like, really dilly-dallying. I had to just go about getting my own.
Wow.
I bought it on Amazon, actually. Huh. It's the same one they would have given me, but they wouldn't get back to me. It was really bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, you guys, you're dropping the ball here. This could be really, this is really diabolical here if, you know.
Right.
If I have an issue at night, but anyway.
Hey, before we get to the break, I wanted to tell you about this. I know you saw the video I posted doing dumbbell bench press, but I wanted to tell you I did one session with this FST specialist. She does fascia stretching therapy. And man, it was amazing. I can't believe, you know, I had talked about it a number of times here on the show. We've talked about, you know, basically I discovered doing lower volume, higher frequency through needing to, because, you know, I couldn't do chest presses for an hour and a half long. It just would cause pain. So I started breaking that up. But now, having visited her once, and I'm going back again tomorrow, my shoulders, both of them, are feeling so much better. Like, there's no pain at all.
And she had diagnosed you, or she was working from the perspective of a bicipital impingement in your shoulder?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. And okay. She started, you know, working everything around that and eventually got to it. And she said that, like, I had I don't know what she meant by this, but she said your bicep tendon is out, as in being, like, out of place, out of alignment, something like that.
Groove. There's a bicipital groove on your humerus where the biceps tendon.
Okay. Well, I guess it wasn't there. I guess it wasn't where it needed to be.
And yeah, that's not good.
Well, I'll tell you what, man. It literally, like, you know, I picked up first, this is, since I'm doing, you know, higher frequency, lower volume, the first two times I trained, I used the same machines that I know I could get away with. And I just tried to go with what I could go with and, you know, just tested it out there. No pain at all. Zero pain. Not even, usually I always, by the second, third set, I'm feeling some sort of pain and I'm having to do everything I can to squeeze the pec and keep it in there. And then the pain stops me, though, not the failure of the muscle.
Mm.
I didn't have that. I went heavier and everything went good. So the third time I decided, okay, I'm going to try dumbbells and I'll start with the 20s, you know, just go really light, just get the feel for it.
Start with the pinks.
Right. Right.
Go the way to the blues and then maybe the greens and then I'll go to the metal ones after that.
Yeah. Yeah. I figured to myself, I might get to the 40s, and if I can get to the 50s, I will call it a day. I did the 20s. Not a problem. Did the 40s. Not a problem. Did the 55s, not a problem. All I felt it was in the muscle. And then I worked up to some decent weight for having not done dumbbell bench press in a year or 3 years, actually.
I saw, yeah.
Yeah, and it felt easy because I'm so used to still pressing. I can still press well. So, I mean, the 90s felt honestly light, like it wasn't tough, which is surprising to me, and there was zero pain.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, I mean, if her assessment was on with your biceps not being in the bicipital groove, it's kind of like having all the lug nuts on all four wheels of your car are loose, and you're trying to, like, see how fast you can drive the car, and the thing's just wobbling like crazy. It's like, there's just no way. So and putting that back in there, aside from the obvious pain, you know, which has just a psychological effect, you've got all sorts of inhibitory neurons, you know, from the pain, the nociceptive neurons that will inhibit the motor neurons and keep you from pressing hard, like you said.
Yeah.
You sense that psychologically because it fucking hurts. You want to stop. But also, if the biceps is not in its proper groove, then you're going to get some proprioceptive information that's going to just, you know, it's kind of like someone who's, like, their meniscus is not in the right place.
Okay.
You know, there's all sorts of proprioceptors in the joint that communicate that information to the spinal cord, and they and they to keep you from hurting yourself even worse, it inhibits motor output. So yeah, so you, I mean, she basically, you know, just like that car with the wobbly tires that are, you know, where the lug nuts aren't tight, you know, you just can't drive it that fast, and it doesn't feel right to drive it that fast, but you can drive it faster now because the wheels are on the way they're supposed to be. The system is put together the way it's meant to be for speed. So yeah, that's just like doubly cool, man. That's really awesome.
Yeah, it blew me away. So I'm going back tomorrow. Well, I'm going to guess we work on that a little bit more again, just to see where I'm at with it. But then we're going onto the low back next and see what we can do there.
You know, I mean, this makes me miss when I got to do, when I was doing a lot of acupuncture and Chinese medicine with people, because it's so fucking cool when someone comes to you and they have this problem they've had forever and it gets fixed really quickly.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, what's next? Yeah. like holy shit. Like they're expecting like 6 months, you know, to fix something. Cause that's a rule of thumb. Like usually I've always kind of gone by like a 3-to-1. Like if you've had something for 3 weeks, you're going to need at least a week to fix it.
Yeah.
You know, if it's 3 years, you might need a year to fix it. But you did it in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Then you're just, like, wow, I can't. It's like it almost feels like this is too good to be true, I imagine.
And that's what I was expecting. I was waiting for it to start hurting any minute, you know? And then I waited for it the next day. The next day it felt just a little bit sore in my left shoulder, which the left shoulder is my better shoulder. Just felt just a tiny bit sore. But I mean,
on the biceps up in the shoulder joint.
But, you know, not bad at all. I mean, really, like on a scale of 1 to 10, maybe a 0.5, you know, it was.
Okay,
so, yeah, yeah. So it surprised me, man. But like you were saying, though, I expected a lot longer. And I was waiting for the other shoe to drop, you know. I was waiting for that point where it was like, okay, yep, you overdid it now.
Yeah. Was your chest just annihilated after all that? Was it just sore as crap?
It wasn't crazy sore because I didn't go, like I said, I didn't go nuts with it. It didn't feel super heavy. And I'm kind of scared to still, you know, like the 90s, hadn't picked those up in a long time, and they're not light when you pick up 90-pound dumbbells, you know, to begin with. And I could go higher, and I feel like my chest could definitely benefit from it, but I'm going to take my time with that. You know, I'm not going to push it too fast.
Is she suggesting you keep doing like the broomstick stretch or something like that to maintain, shoulder flexibility and keep the biceps where it's supposed to be?
She hadn't. I'm going to talk to her about it tomorrow when I see her to see, you know, what she thinks I should do. And I'm going to keep going back about every 7 to 10 days for a while too, just to keep getting tuned up, because it was definitely well worth it.
Yeah. Prevention, you know, cause if you just keep doing what you've been doing, then this, you know, this can obviously recur.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so you want to keep that from happening. Have you ever heard of power hooks?
Power hooks. Are they kind of like straps, but they're hooks?
No, those are different. Yeah. Those are the lifting hooks.
Yeah.
Power hooks, powerhooks.com. I have no affiliation with them. I just think it's a cool product.
Use Stevenson 10.
Yeah, no, I know it's Stevenson 10. You know, no affiliation, but I think that coupon, I think that discount code will work for you. They've got like a permanently affixed version, I think, for like using Olympic handles that you add weights to. The only ones that I've used are the ones that you can put on whatever dumbbells you want. And basically, it's just some light Velcro strap that hooks this hook onto a dumbbell, and the hook would allow you to hang the dumbbell over a barbell, or I usually would use a Smith machine.
Yeah,
Dave Henry and I used to use these a lot because it's just easier with another person to set it all up. But for like heavy overhead dumbbell presses, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Getting those fuckers up is a pain in the ass.
Yes, yes.
So with this, you would just go and you can actually just hook the thing onto the dumbbell around the dumbbell handle, and then you just use it to lug the dumbbell over where you need, and you just put there's another hook that's the thing's like about 12 inches long, I guess.
Okay.
And that goes over the barbell, or I usually use a Smith machine bar. You could use any bar that you want, really. So like if you're on like if you want to do a dumbbell flat benches on a regular barbell flat bench, you would just leave the bar in place. You put these things on each dumbbell and then you hook the dumbbells onto the bar.
Yeah.
And they're just they're literally just dangling there above you.
So you don't have to kick them up, basically.
No, you just lift them off, and when you're done, you just hook them back.
Nice.
Yeah, the only thing is that if you do go to failure and you can't hook them back,
yeah,
and you like just dump the dumbbells, they can get bent.
Okay.
I've done that a few times. I've gone through a few pairs by, okay, you know, just trying to, because I mean, better a bent power hook than a torn pec or
right
shoulder. But what I've done there, I had a video of this. I don't remember if I got it up on YouTube, but I've actually, I'm gonna have to do this then, I guess, now since I'm talking about it, people are gonna be asking me to do it. But, I've taken, daisy chains. I need to bust out my new set of daisy chains I got, but I've taken daisy chains and used those, took the power hooks onto a, cause the power hooks hold, the dumbbell sort of pretty well. You don't have to use the power hooks. You could just use, do this with daisy chains, but a daisy chain going around a dumbbell, okay, handle kind of gets the daisy chains kind of in the way,
yeah,
of grabbing the dumbbell. With the power hooks, there's nothing in the way. So let's say you're doing a dumbbell flat bench and you want to do like a muscle round where you'd have to, or even like a rest pause set. That was one of the big pains in the butt with doing rest pause training with dog crap is that if you're going to do like a heavy incline dumbbell press,
you have to get them in place three times.
Yeah, each time. And yeah, it would just, you'd lose at least a rep just getting those things into place. And that's why we started using the power hooks.
Okay.
But the other problem then is that if you got the power hooks and you're going to failure and you're dead at the bottom of the rep, then you just have to dump the thing.
Mm.
So the solution was to put, like if you're in a Smith machine, for instance, put the bar up high and use some daisy chains hooked to the power hooks. So basically the dumbbells are just dangling there at the bottom of the range of motion. So you start with the dumbbells down low and you just press up and down.
Yeah.
And they're constantly connected. They're constantly just hanging there with the daisy chains.
Right.
You can do your set of four. You can do a rest pause set, take it to failure. When you're done, you just bring the dumbbells down at the bottom of the range of motion. You just let go and squirm out if you want, or just lie there and wait until you're get ready for the next part of your set.
Wow, I love that. That's great.
Yeah. It takes a little while to set up, and you know, you wouldn't set that whole thing up for your warm-ups. You just do it when you get to your go weight.
Right.
Otherwise,
right,
you know, it'd take forever. You take 45 minutes to get to a set. But once you're – it's kind of nice because, you know, there is something to say. People always say you're a little bit stronger sometimes when you know you got a good spot, or yeah, like you're in a rack versus being – some people like the fear of being outside a rack where there's nothing to hold them up. But
right.
Right.
I always, you know, had that sense that I can sort of, you know, release the governor on a set if I knew that if I get in trouble, I can just drop the weight.
Right. Absolutely.
This pretty much allows you to do that as long as you set things up properly so you don't, you know, end up sort of pinned under the weight at the bottom of the range of motion.
I like that. Yeah, I'd love to see a video if you've got something like that, or if you put something together. That'd be cool.
Yeah, I have filmed it once, but I'll see if I can do one of those. You got to have the everything, you know, available in the gym, but I'll see if I can put one of those together.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what do you say we take a quick break, and when we get back, we've got a whole bunch of questions to answer.
Cool. Let's do it.
All right, guys. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, this is John Meadows.
And this is Scott Stevenson.
I invite everybody to come out to our seminar, Bodybuilding Fact and Fiction.
Thursday, March 1st at the Doubletree Suites in downtown Columbus. Just before the Arnold Classic festivities, come on in and meet John Meadows, IFBB Pro, the Mountain Dog himself, and Dr. Scott Stevenson. Stay all day from 9 a.m. to noon, then after lunch, 1 o'clock till 4. Starting out with an a.m. pancake breakfast, then all-day lectures. Q&A as time permits, plus best bar ever, and pre-workout from Granite Supplement Speed Force to get you on your way to the gym. For more information, go to drscottstevenson.com. That's drscottstevenson.com. And hope to see you guys there. If you've enjoyed Scott Stevenson's contribution to Muscle Minds, you can learn more about him, his products, and his services at fortitudetraining.net. And if you order any of his products or services, you get a free subscription to his message board where he answers questions daily. Go to fortitudetraining.net to learn more about all these products, services, and events offered by Scott Stevenson. All right, guys, and we are back. We've got questions
over at the Advices forums. It's forum.advicesradio.com. And then we also have a thread over at Scott's forum, which you can either get to by going to drscottstevenson.com or Fortitude Training site, or this is the integrativebodybuilding.com site though. Excuse me. Integrative bodybuilding. Let's see if I can get that right this time. Okay. Moving on. Starting at integrative bodybuilding, there was a question, and this is something I know nothing about, so I wanted to hear what your thoughts were on this, Scott, because it's something I know nothing of. It's about casein A1 versus casein A2. His question is, what are your thoughts regarding a large population of people being unable to digest and utilize the protein casein A1 and therefore being advised to seek specific casein A2 dairy pod products or avoid dairy altogether? Do you think that there is merit, or could the research simply have the agenda of pushing and marketing certain products, i.e., you know, A2 milk? Is there merit that could casein A1 consumption have negative implications on one's ability to maximize body composition?
So this is a really interesting question. I've been asked this a few times over the years, and I don't follow it along all that often, but it's really kind of fascinating because I'm not like a conspiracy theorist kind of person, but this is the dairy industry we're talking about here. Hmm. And it's a really kind of interesting phenomenon, because the research literature is just sort of, it's scant in a strange way. It's like, why aren't there more like really well done reviews on this topic in the scientific literature? I looked again after this question popped up, and I found some reviews, but they were in some obscure journals. Hmm. And they're really short. There's also a couple, what was the name of the one? There's a European group that put together a nice review. So I can get the name of this thing here while I'm sitting at the computer. Here, hold on just a sec. I look some of these things and put in my old database.
All right.
A European group. Come on, buddy. Let me cut some of this out here while I'm fumbling around.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's the European Food Safety Authority.
Okay.
Let's put together a review. Here's the basic idea. Cows, depending on their genetics, what ends up being the casein component of the milk protein. So there's casein and there's whey, and those can be obviously separated. Some of them will have a gene. It's the A1 gene that produces an A1 protein in their beta casein, which is the casein protein, the milk protein.
Okay.
And that gets cleaved away through digestion. There's a number of enzymatic pathways that you can end up with this. It's a 7-amino acid protein. And in the cows that have the genetics for this, you'll form what's called BCM7 or beta-casomorphin-7. And what that is, and there are a multitude of these proteins in casein. It's an opioid agonist, so it has opioid activity. One of the reasons why casein is digested so slowly, as opposed to whey or whey hydroxylate or hydroxylate of casein too, is that if you take in intact casein, you get these opioid agonists.
Hmm.
And they act, yeah, this is pretty cool stuff. First you get the protein kind of forms a clot, which it'll form kind of a clot in your shaker bottle or your blender, you know.
Sure.
If you've noticed that. So that's probably part of it, just a mechanical clotting of the, it's not totally mechanical, but just you've got this sort of big clotted, resistant to mechanical digestion type of protein glob in your gut. But also these opioids attach to opioid receptors in the gut, and it slows the digestive processes there.
Hmm.
So that's why casein is quote unquote a slow protein. And it releases amino acids more slowly over the course of time. It's why people put it in nighttime proteins and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
It was in the Team Skip protein, which I think you can still get it.
Yep, you can.
Nutrition. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it's your nutrition.
One third of the Team Skip protein. So this particular BCM7, which only comes in A1 casein, is an interesting one. They've sort of figured out epidemiologically, and this is where the research is kind of like, it's really fascinating. They haven't followed up on this. There's all this cross-sectional data associating this with cardiovascular disease, insulin-dependent diabetes, autoimmune conditions, all sorts of stuff. Child sudden death syndrome, even atherosclerosis, you know, cardiovascular disease. So, but the mechanisms are really not entirely clear as to what the heck's going on here. If you inject this this stuff, and they've done this with animal models, and you can even do it in people, you get like an inflammatory response from this BCM7. So this particular casomorphin, this opioid agonist casomorphin, is pro-inflammatory, but what I'm not finding. This is like a big kind of hole. Is the human research where they measured, you know, you think this would have been done again and again and again and replicated, how much of the stuff actually gets into the bloodstream.
Yeah.
It does seem like it's absorbed very well. So it may just stay in the gut. That doesn't mean it can't affect the body, because we have a microbiome there, which is intimately involved with inflammation. So autoimmune disorders, we're talking about immunity, immune responses, inflammation. Type 1 diabetes is maybe an autoimmune issue in some cases. Somehow the nervous system, or the immune system, gets sort of confused and attacks its own beta cells in the pancreas. Cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, that's an immune issue. So the connection that, you know, that's interesting is that if you have an impaired immune system, and a lot of your lymphatic tissue, a tremendous amount of the body's lymphatic tissue, which sort of the vessels for the immune system, as opposed to arteries and veins, the vessels for the cardiovascular system, is there in your gut, because your gut, I think I mentioned this, maybe it was on a different podcast, but your whole GI tract is technically outside your body. Did I mention this?
No.
I think it was on another podcast.
Well, yeah, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it actually is. So have you ever, like, there's some, I always think of the yogis in India that would, like, when they're fasting for days upon days, and they would take a swab of cloth, like a really long piece of cloth or gauze, and they would swallow it. Ugh. And they would, you know, they could guide it all the way through their GI tract until it came out their butt, out of their anus.
Oh,
and you can swab your whole GI system that way. There wouldn't be anything there because, you know, they hadn't been eating for a long time. But if you imagine like an apple or, you know, a water balloon, something, you know, round sphere, and you core out the center of it, then there's a big hole in this, you know, in this sphere. That hole then is technically outside of the mass of what's remaining after you've held the sphere, right?
Yeah. Okay.
It's outside the body, or outside the sphere. Like, that's an outer surface.
Yeah. No longer part of the apple. I get it.
It's no longer part of the apple. Yeah. So that surface there where the core was taken out is now the outside of the apple, even though it's inside of what used to be the sphere of the apple. That's where your mouth is the top of that, and your anus is the bottom of that.
Yeah.
So to speak. So your GI system is outside your body, and so when you take in food, it's stuff coming from the exterior of your body.
Okay.
Something from outside. So it makes sense. Like, this is like, we're intentionally, like, this is like the front gates for bringing stuff from outside inside your body. You've got basically your GI and your lungs, you know, or the rest of your body. You've got your skin, where you've also got a lot of immune systems too. So, you know, your dermis, or the integument, is an important organ, obviously, for keeping stuff out or letting in only, you know, things that you want to, which isn't much, you know. That's by drugs, transdermal delivery is one way to get stuff in, but you have to formulate that to sort of get past this normal layer. And then the GI tract is just, it's basically kind of a semi-porous way in. So there's, you know, GI physiology is absolutely fascinating. Their enteric nervous system is, it's highly regulated. There's all sorts of peptide hormones that are there that are controlling GI motility and secretions, and your immune system's there, like, it's surveilling the sucker. So if you got someone where there's some impairment there, and this BCM7, this A1 casein drive beta casomorphin 7 makes its way into the body, that would normally tell you that you've got some impairment of your immune system. You may have, you know, too much inflammation there, or something is not functioning properly, because that normally wouldn't be absorbed from what I've been able to find. Typically, this would just stay in the GI tract. So if that's the situation, such your GI is impaired, there's a possibility that other aspects of your inflammatory response are also impaired. And a lot of the things that are associated with the casein A1 are inflammation or immune system related. So it kind of makes sense. If you've got poor defenses on the outside of your fortress, it also would make sense you'd have a lot of citizens inside your fortress who aren't doing good. You'd have a lot of mayhem in there. If you let in the scoundrels because you don't have good guards at your gates, it would make sense that you'd have a lot of scoundrel-like activity, meaning stuff like cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, autoimmune issues.
Yeah.
So it makes sense the two are coupled, essentially. So, but it's also been connected with schizophrenia and like postpartum psychosis, kind of like in mothers after they've given birth. There's a connection there that's sort of widespread, but I haven't seen it. It's just been studied epidemiologically. People haven't looked into it, and it just makes me wonder, this is the conspiracy thing of, you know, whether there's the dairy people who are trying to make money selling cow's milk, and that's a whole other issue, are somehow having their way with preventing some of this information getting out, because, like, I mean, how do you get funding for this stuff? Where's that come from? So there's some possibility that stuff does obviously happen. So it's going to be a matter of maybe an impaired GI tract, whether this is an issue for you, for somebody. And the question here, bringing it back to bodybuilding, is if typically what will happen with the A1 casein 2, this is sort of the obvious instances of whether you've got an issue there, is you'll have GI distress.
Okay. That'll be the first thing you notice, right?
Yeah. You'll get diarrhea and that kind of stuff. Yeah. So it will disrupt, you know, your GI system. So then you'd know if there's an issue. So, you know, common sense, you just take care of that. But you may not know that it's the A1 versus the A2, which is the other type of beta casein that doesn't seem to be an issue. So that would be the first thing to do. So whether or not, I mean, the steps here is coming from a practical standpoint, all the scientific issues aside, is if you really think you want to take in milk protein, or you're having trouble drinking milk, if there's an issue, is if it's causing a GI distress, seek out, and you can find, there's a company, all you have to do is Google A2 milk protein or A2 casein, and you'll find companies that have the, they use the breeds of cows that don't have the A1 gene.
Okay.
And you can get milk from them.
Is that common? To find this? I mean, is this something that would be available at most stores, this A2 variety?
I've not seen it labeled. Won't necessarily know, you know, that I think they, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of the dairy industry. Maybe someone could comment on Facebook or even on the board if they do, as to, you know, this isn't something one of the interesting part about it this is why the question is a really good one, is like, are people making a big deal of this? You know, and trying to like shuck and jive those who are a little bit paranoid into buying highly priced A2 only milk.
Yeah.
There's really no need for it. Or is there a cover up? Is there a cover up? You know, is the dairy industry, you know, milk and dairy industry covering this up? Because, you know, it would create a separate market, you know? And,
yeah.
Who knows? I mean, the thing that's, you know, talked about placebos before too is, you know, the placebo effect can be a really powerful one and really sort of be even more powerful than what we think we know about how the body will respond physiologically to a some particular condition we expose it to. So, you know, someone who like really likes to drink milk and eat dairy and they just like it's part of their, you know, their culture, the foods that they typically eat, you know, their ethnic related foods that they eat or just what are comfort foods for them. And they're having problems and then they find, oh, well, you know, I can get this A2 only milk. Then that like disrupts the whole dairy industry. I don't know what that means in terms of what happens to some farmers or what happens to some of the milk production. How much A1 is in there? I don't know. You'd have to have the right equipment, you know, to test the milk to see, you know, whether it's in there or not. It would be very, very difficult, I think, for the average person. You wouldn't be able to do it. So, and to track down what the what the genetics actually are of the cows. You know, I don't even know what the genetics are of the A1. I have to go look that up and see, you know, does this, what percentage of cows have the A1 versus the A2. So this could create, it's probably a lot easier just to dump A1 and A2 milk into the milk supply, so to speak, and not have to partition that out and not worry about it, as opposed to now we've got, you know, everyone, there's this high demand for A2 milk and people aren't buying milk unless it's A2. That could really put a damper on the sales of a lot of milk for a lot of milk producers if they only have A1 cows that don't provide that. So there's reason to think, you know, that people would not want this to happen, because basically it means, you know, some part of the milk product is poorly digested, you know, or it causes all these issues. And these are big issues: atherosclerosis, sudden death syndrome, diabetes, you know, psychoses, schizophrenia. There's associations that are there, you know, at least that have, you know, some studies have suggested are there.
Yeah. I've never heard anything about that. That's crazy.
Exactly. That's kind of like, well, that's why you make think conspiracy, because it's, you know, it's out there. So, and that's why, you know, but the research hasn't, you know, see it all over the place.
Hmm.
I think, you know, it kind of come down to, the individual and what their immune system is, and kind of making their own decision. You can try, and that's, I think that's, you know, one of the nice things is that we do have an economy that's large enough and to sort of buoy companies that want to produce A2 only milk, and, you know, try a few gallons of it, you know,
yeah.
See if it matters. If you don't notice anything, then that's not going to tell you everything, but it would give you some idea maybe of whether you have an issue there.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, if so, anybody has any feedback on this one or any experiences of their own, I'd love to hear it if they wanted to, say, post up on the thread or something when we put this on, you know, Facebook or Instagram.
Yeah, I mean, I could probably, it's one of those things where, like, this is the type of thing that, you know, you could see as like a large part of a documentary.
Yeah.
I have a sense where someone literally would go, I had to go and spend like days and days digging the literature. Because it's just a fishy body of literature from what I found. It's just kind of odd. It's like, why am I not paying closer attention to this? You know, it's the same thing with raw and pasteurized milk. You know, it's like, it varies state by state, but have we talked about raw milk before here?
We have not, no.
Yeah, I don't know. You probably talked about it with somebody on one of the podcasts.
You know what? I never have. I've known people who have used it, it's never been a topic. It's actually, that's a good point, though. It should be.
Well, you know, a lot of people find that their issues with milk goes away.
Hmm.
The milk will go away when they switch, when they drink raw milk versus pasteurized. And it tastes really good, too.
Yeah.
You know, there are podcast interviews with bodybuilders who claim like it had like this sort of magical anabolic effect for them as well.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not, I don't think it's universal, but trying to get hold of raw milk is very, very difficult. The way you have to get it in most places is you have to basically become a part owner in like a cooperative.
Yeah.
Where you own part of a cow.
Right.
So you're actually, you typically, you legally make yourself into a farmer. you know, you own 1/100 of a cow, and that affords you, like, you know, 2 gallons of milk a week or something like that. Yeah. And you got to go pick it up.
I've known a guy who did that.
Yeah. John Meadows used to, I think.
Did he?
To go to I'm pretty sure he did for a while. I'm not sure if he does anymore. I haven't heard him talk about it, but he had some videos where he went out, I think went out to the farm there. At least I know he's talked about it.
That's right. I do remember that him mentioning that now.
Mm-hmm. In Arizona, where things are, a lot of health and nutrition related things are pretty loose. You can find raw milk.
Okay.
In the earthy, crunchy health food stores. it's good, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fat separates and everything. It's, you know, you get the full blown stuff.
Yeah, I think probably like a lot of the listeners, I haven't drank milk in a long time.
Yeah. Right. You know, and that's a whole other ball of wax. But it's just the reason I bring it up is that, you know, it's the raw milk is like, that's really impossible to get. Like, why is this a threat? It makes you think, what's the threat here? Why can't we, you know, you just can't go buy some raw milk from someone. It's like, come on, like, these are cows.
Right.
You know, like, what, we had the agricultural revolution, like, you know, 12,000 years ago, like, you know, and people have been milking cows for how long? You just can't go get milk from a cow. Like, that's illegal to go get raw milk. It's illegal some places to go buy raw milk.
I think it is here in Michigan.
Yeah, it's friggin' illegal. Like, how crazy is that?
Yeah.
I don't know where it fits with, you know, other laws, but it's like, you know, is it equivalent to robbing a convenience store? Like, like, what's the deal here?
Yeah, yeah.
So it just makes you wonder, you know, if there's not another reason, because, I mean, a concern, of course, would be that, you know, pasteurization is there to kill off microbes, you know, the heating up process is to, you know, prevent you from getting sick.
Right.
So, you know, they want to kind of legislate that and prevent that from people from drinking, you know, bad raw milk. But anyway.
All right. I will pick up over at the advices forums for the next question. And this one is about Widowmaker sets. He says, so I'm not sure if this is the right place to post it. And I think it was, personally. he says, but my first question, he just joined the board, by the way. So thanks for joining. my first question is directed at Dr. Scott Stevenson concerning Widowmaker sets on squats. My lifts are more powerlifting oriented, so I'm usually pretty low volume and heavy weight, but Dr. Scott Stevenson loves his Widowmaker sets. So since I need to mix it up anyway, and I'm pretty much convinced, much like Jordan Peters seems to be, that Dr. Scott Stevenson is the, I'm going to say, the effing oracle. I figured, let's give these Widowmakers a try. So my question is, how much weight should I be using and how many sets am I going for? I know the rep range to shoot for is somewhere around 20 to 30 based off of what I've heard Dr. Scott say, but that's about it. I'm doing free weight squats and my 3 rep max is 515. Based off that information, what sort of weight should I use? Is there a percentage of my max that I should be trying to go for, or should I just play it by feel? I hate to admit that so far I've only done 3 sessions in which I've been able to do 2 sets of 315 for 20 reps, followed by a set of 275 for about 16 to 18. It's great, by the way. It sucks balls, but it's great. should I be dropping the weight and increasing the reps, or should I be trying to do a little bit more with the weight that I'm using? I'm also bearing in mind that doing low rep workouts as long as I have is also probably playing a factor on my endurance. But regardless, I'd love to hear Dr. Stevenson's thoughts on the best way to approach these Widowmaker sets. Thanks. And he says he's also planning on getting the Fortitude ebook, which, since he posted this a couple months ago, he's probably already been through the program twice now.
I know. I have to see. I have all these questions transcribed onto my own little list, so I don't know what his name on the forum was. What was his name on the forum? Maybe I...
Bama Dan. And I just got a crazy cramp in my in my Ooh. Obliques.
Oh, Ooh. Nice.
So I'm stretching that out.
Okay. Yeah,
I'm good.
All right. Breeze. Yeah. Taurine. Throw some taurine and some electrolytes in and some water.
Right.
So he's a power lifter. But he just wants to do this because I am the fucking Oracle.
Don't make me laugh again.
I know. Sorry. I'm going to try to give you a full body cramp here. Much more powerlifting oriented. I'm guessing he's a bodybuilder, though. He just hasn't done a whole lot of high rep training. So,
yeah.
So the Widowmaker I think I heard that before, but Dante Trudell definitely sort of, you know, put that on the map as far as kind of a training technique with dog crap training.
Yeah.
And you have to use these, you know, in the appropriate measure, or you can, if you're doing them the right way, or you can quickly push yourself into an overreached situation or worse. But it's not just a 20 rep set. It's a 20 rep set to the death.
Yes.
So to speak, you know, meaning that if you were married, at the end of the set, your wife would now be technically a widow because you have made her one with a widow maker by killing yourself through the course of the effort. So you're going to do as many reps as you can. You know, obviously you literally don't want to kill yourself, but with the given weight that you've chosen. So I was thinking like 315 would be a good place to start. And he's doing he's doing two sets of 315 for 20 reps. But I'm guessing that those are not real Widowmakers.
Okay.
Because you're only going to do about one of those.
Yeah.
If you do it right, because you try to, you're taking a strategy where you're extending the set out as long as you can to get as many reps as possible without putting the weight down. So he might, if he's going to do 315, let's say he did, you know, 15 in a row, and then he did like two or three more, and then took a couple breaths and did a double, and then he put it down. He might do like 12. And then depending on, like for me with squats, for instance, I put the bar, it's comfortable a little bit lower. And I have to stoop forward a little bit to keep the bar in place, especially because I'm usually using a top squat attachment too.
Okay.
To work. So my low back is the thing I have to manage, not my legs. But a lot of people who do really well with the high bar squat can just stand there with the weight and let their legs recover, and their low back isn't terribly taxed because they're not sort of kipping forward to keep the bar in place on their traps.
Yeah.
So you would rest as long as you like to recover, and then do a few more reps and pick whatever strategy that works with your fatigue and your mental state to try to crank out as many reps as you can. And the idea, literally, I've talked about this before, is that you imagine that if you don't get another rep, then that's maybe your demise, or the demise of your wife, or the demise of your family, or, you know, something absolutely catastrophic is going to happen unless you get another rep. You have to do another rep. You don't put the weight down until you get another rep. You got another rep in you. You got another rep in you, and you just keep on doing that. And you strategize the set to basically make it as hard as you possibly can to sort of teeter on the edge of that failure rep where you literally can't get another one. You're actually, in a way, you're trying to do as many reps you can while avoiding failure. Cause when you fail, you're over.
Yeah.
That's, you know, so, he mentioned fortitude training. This is kind of the opposite of what I have people do in fortitude training, because the idea being that you can only do like one of these Widowmakers and then that's it. It just taxes your nervous system so much. I have people do continuous repetitions on all aspects, even with the muscle rounds, which are cluster sets broken up by intended rest intervals. When you do the reps, they're continuous, because it's this teetering on that failure rep where you're at the really, really tough grinder reps. Again and again and again and again throughout a set where you're like literally trying to torture you and anyone who's watching you, those are the ones that really beat you to hell. But they build a lot of grit. They make everything else seem easy, literally. And at least many things seem really easy. And they provide a tremendous stimulus too. So you just have to choose them wisely as to how many you can do. If you're able to do like a real Widowmaker, like more than one, you could. I mean, you know, if your life depended on it, you would do it again and again and again, but your performance would be really, really bad and you would just be annihilated.
Yeah.
You'd just be, you know, just gone. So it's just kind of imagine you want to make it the hardest set of your entire life. Like literally, like this is what people are going to remember. It'd be, I have, you know, 5 minutes on video to, you know, say my goodbyes. This is my expression of my spirit, of my soul, who the fuck I am. You know, this is it right here. I'm letting it all out.
That sounds very Tom Platz to me.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like the next question, but yeah, that's really kind of like where these are supposed to be. And then you progress with them, you know, so you, there's different ways to use Widowmakers in DC training. That's kind of where they fit, where I know how to fit them in. I did some of these this last year. This is where, you know, I threw some in from my prep. I just had the feeling like I wanted to be a little bit stupid, and I was able to get away with it. So, but I was only doing one a week. But you progress with those. So let's say you get 19 reps once, and then you get your rep range is, let's say, 20 to 30, which is or maybe 25 would be your upper end. You keep progressing until you get to 25, and then you increase the weight, so you're back down around 20 again, and you just keep doing that. With DC training, with the standard two-way, you'd only do a Widowmaker you do one Widowmaker each time you train legs, and you could either use the same exercise, which I wouldn't suggest for legs.
No.
Or a different one each time. So you might do a Widowmaker on a leg press. You could do a Widowmaker on like some sort of standing squat machine, and a Widowmaker on a back squat, a barbell squat or a Smith squat, something like that. If you do the three-way split, which is a little more advanced, you can do body part Widowmakers. And so you might have a Widowmaker for chest, one for back, and maybe one for calves. Something like that. Usually three or four is kind of the max for most people with that split, if they're really training and making good progress. Otherwise you'll end up doing too much.
Yeah.
If you're doing five, like that's the most I think I've ever had anyone do when I was coaching people with dog crap training. Those are the same sort of things. You just can't put the weight down. That's the thing. There has to be some continuous tension, which makes it different than a cluster set, like a rest pause set or a muscle round.
Yeah.
Because there is going to be some built-in fatigue, but it varies. Like if you're on a leg press, that's different than a squat because your low back isn't going to be the thing that gives out. It's going to be your legs.
Absolutely. So those
leg press Widowmakers, you know, people got to watch out for, you know, locking out their knees and hyperextending the knee. But I've seen people do that. Like they lock out. You're like, oh man, I'm waiting for your leg to collapse the wrong way. But those can be, if once you learn how to go,
yeah,
and just like, you know, you find a pain management strategy and a fatigue management strategy, you can just keep going forever. Those are really, really brutal.
I love those. I wonder for him, he's been lifting in a very low rep range. I feel like it's going to be a challenge for him for a while, especially on something like squats, because the amount of air it takes. You know, I find for me, that's one of my limiting factors is, you know, once I get to the point where I can only get one rep at a time, I'll knock out that rep and then I need to gasp, you know?
Yeah.
And I knock out that rep and I'm probably already at, you know, we'll say 20 reps. Those last handful of reps where I'm just getting one or two, it's me trying to take air in between, you know, and that's my limiting factor. And the more I've done it, though, the easier that gets, the better my cardio is. If I were only doing like three rep sets, trying to get 20 would be brutal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you could only do three before you had to take a break, you probably would never get to 20.
Yeah.
It'd be too heavy, you know. Yeah. But yeah, so you have to manage the breathing. And then, you know, with back squats, you have to manage your low back. Like for me, that would use that. That could be, that's kind of the, I've gotten to that point where I'm like, screw the low back. This is like, I've tried the strategy. Just screw the low back. I'm just going to worry about my legs. And I just sort of forget about the low back fatigue that's sort of creeping up on me.
Yeah.
And try to rest. And then I end up resting too long and I'm getting my legs get fresh. Mm. And then eventually I just sort of like kind of crumble forward.
Okay.
And then I'm like, oh, this isn't smart because, you know, I'm going to blow out a disc.
Yeah.
if I do this, you know, let my low back round. So yeah, sometimes on back squats, depending on how you do them, you've got to manage both the breathing where you're going to gas out and low back and your legs. So it's just like a triple whammy of discomfort.
Yeah. For me, the leg press is easier to, you know, approach this method with, you know, because mm-hmm. like you said, you've just got to worry about your legs at that point, making sure you're not locking out.
Yep. Like hamstring curls are fun to do this way.
Mm.
I find like on a seated hamstring curl.
I've never done a hamstring curl, Widowmaker.
Oh, they're fun. Yeah. A lot of times there's not a lot of tension at the top. So you can like literally you won't put the weight down. If you're using a stack or like a plate loader, when you haven't actually set the weight down all the way.
Yeah.
So you're obeying the rules of the Widowmaker, but there's not a lot of tension. So you can rest pretty well.
So you're talking about like the seated, not the prone.
Yeah. Like a seated one.
Yeah.
Those seem to be especially well suited for this. So you can just keep on cranking.
I bet.
Yeah, you can go and go and go on those, which makes them fun, I think, because it's like, you know, you end up doing like a 4-minute set or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in some exercises, you know, you're just like, if you try to do like a barbell press or something like that,
yeah,
it's just like there's no recovery between reps.
Yeah.
You know, you're just holding too much weight and there's too much tension that, you know, it's not as well suited as for Widowmaker as other exercises where you can get more recovery and just grind out those reps.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. So, but that's the Widowmaker. It's really, but you just gotta, you'll get better at them the more you do them. And then you'll only be able to do like one of them. You only want to do one of them.
Well, once you're done, I feel like I can't think of anything else I want to do in that workout. You know what I mean? Like what else could I do right now?
No, like if you did them right, you're like, that's it. I'm dead.
Yeah.
No, I'm lucky if I can drive home, you know?
Do you take any additional rest time before you do the Widowmaker setting up for it than you would for a normal set?
I probably do, just like psyching up.
Yeah.
You know, most, for me, well, the way I've been trained most of my life, there's no, I'm not like moving. My working sets, I'm getting pretty close to maximal recovery.
Okay.
There's not a whole lot of sets because I'm not doing volume training where I'm just trying to, you know, accumulate volume of training.
Yeah.
And allowing there to be, you know, good amount of fatigue and just doing, you know, rep after rep after rep. A lot of it is, you know, logbook based, performance based.
Yeah.
Stuff. So in a Widowmaker, yeah, it's just that. You know, it's like you're trying to beat the logbook. So that's the thing that you can run into with DC training or any logbook based program is, you know, to some degree, I have to admit this, I know this has played a role in fortitude training is someone or DC training, any program like that. If someone's come from a volume training background where they were doing pretty short rest intervals and, you know, they're good at sort of being attuned to their fatigue level, they will make gains in the logbook simply because they're resting more between exercises.
Right, right.
They're just more recovered. They're giving themselves 5 minutes instead of 2.5.
Yeah.
You know, and that's going to give them, you know, another 3 or 4 reps on a lot of exercises, regardless of how much their fitness has changed. So, yeah, I try to, like, any exercise that is really like a keystone or sort of a cornerstone progress monitoring exercise where, you know, this is the one one you're really using to drive muscle growth.
Yeah.
Because you want to get better at it. You just want to like just brutalize the exercise and own it. Become massively strong on that exercise because you know it targets the muscle you're trying to hit really well. You gotta watch for that, you know, because eventually you're just trying to like microload, you know, you're adding 2.5 pound plates, you know, you're just for one rep. I get asked a question. And he didn't follow up. I don't know if he didn't make my answer. He didn't like my answer. But there was somebody who was just looking in the fortitude training on my site, and they were asking, and he had done DC training in the past. And one of the things he had used, and this isn't how I ever did with anyone with DC training. It's just not practical. But one of the things that he employed with DC training on the exercise you'd rotate through is that if he didn't improve on both sets, let's say you do a heavy and a light set for back thickness or something like that. If you didn't improve on both sets, I think every single workout he would drop the exercise.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's pretty strict. You'd be dropping exercise pretty fast.
Yeah, you would think.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'd end up, you know, rotating through exercise. You never get to be one of those guys, you know, who is grinding rep after rep after rep, you know, week after week after week. I remember Dante long time ago posting, he was bragging on one of his trainees, and he had taken out the progression on a particular exercise that this guy had made over the course of like a year and a half.
Okay.
And he started off, it may have been like bent over rows or something like that. And it just like traced like the heavy set maybe, or maybe it was both sets. I can't recall. It's been a while, but he just had like, it was like this, it was like, you know, however many, it was probably like 40 lines because he was doing this like every third workout.
Hmm.
And it was like a year and a half, something like that. So 30 or 40 lines. And, you know, it was 315 by 8, 315 by 9, 315 by 10. Wow. 315 by 10, 320 by 8,
wow.
325 by 9, you know, just yeah. like creeping forward. But he kept on doing it, you know, week after week. There was always like there were a couple weeks where he sort of stalled a little bit.
Yeah.
But then he'd cruise, you know, he'd take some time off, and he was doing a nice job with the cruises. He'd come back, and he just crept forward. He grinded it out week after week after week. And after a year and a half, he was doing bent over rows with 405. Instead of 315. And I tell people that, like, if you train, let's say you train an exercise 15 times in the course of the year.
Right.
You know, and you add, let's say, just 5 pounds each time you do that. There's 45 pounds to that exercise. So if you went from, like, let's say that's roughly 50 pounds, 225 to 275 on an incline press, the same number of reps. That's going to show, I would guess. If you've been training for long enough, that's just not neurological gains. If you keep doing that year after year, next thing you know, you're at 315, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Did Dante include any pictures out of curiosity of the guy's progress as well?
That's a thing, man. I wish there was limited server space.
All
the old files and stuff. Yeah. He had tons and tons of pictures. I don't know if he has them anywhere.
Yeah.
If he you know archived them someplace, but you might, I don't know, if you go to the Wayback Machine,
mm-hmm.
you know about the Wayback Machine?
I do. Yeah.
Yeah. You might be able to go find some of those old threads that are now not visible on Intense Muscle, and they might have the pictures in there. I don't know if those are archived there or not, but yeah, he had tons of trainees pictures, tons of them.
I mean, I knew I had seen a bunch of them that were amazing. I just, but and if you remembered, if he had some in that guy's situation, because like you're saying, man, it seems like, yeah, if you were to make that kind of progress over a year's time, I'm sure that the progress in his development had to have changed too, you know?
I'm pretty sure that guy was the guy who went by the name of Khan.
Okay.
K-H-A-N, who did make some really good progress.
Nice.
The young guy. Yeah, he made some really good progress. So, as far as the Widowmakers go in rest intervals, you know, if you're trying to really drive growth and progression with those Widowmakers, then you kind of want to, you know, make sure that there's, you know, you're pretty much fully recovered and keep that as a constant, as opposed to like, you know, one day I just like said, fuck it, I'm going for it. And you were 3 minutes post your last set. Whereas the other day you were 5 minutes, because that'll make a difference of 5 reps, possibly. So.
Well, hey, I'm going to grab one more question here because we're kind of running out of time. But this really tied in well, and this is back from Integrative Bodybuilding. He says, many years ago, I saw an interview. This is from Punisher, by the way. Many years ago, I saw an interview with Tom Platz in which he said, bodybuilding is more mental than physical. Of course, this can be interpreted in many different ways and on many different levels. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on the mental aspects of bodybuilding and how to go about cultivating a super strong mindset. I know this question is very open-ended, Run with it, interpret it, and interpret it however you see fit. That's a good one. I like this.
Oh, man. I could just, like, go on and
This is a great question.
It's an awesome question. So the way I look at that question, because I totally agree with that statement, you know, it all starts with your mind.
Hmm.
Everything, like, you know, physiologically, every time you're moving, every time you're lifting, it's, you know, it's a matter of what's going on in your brain. You know, human performance really ultimately is a function of your nervous system. You know, you've got obviously got limitations in the muscle and the genetics of, you know, how well a muscle can adapt and all that kind of thing. But, you know, if you're not training, you're not adapting. And that training is a function of psychology and neurology. You know, you have to go in there and have the desire to do it, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it definitely is more mental than physical, I think, because without the mental, the physical doesn't happen. So that kind of goes without saying in a certain way, but the toughest part of that is cultivating a strong mindset.
Hmm.
How to cultivate that in somebody.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was just talking with somebody the other day about, exercise adherence. I was talking with a friend who was telling me about a friend of hers that, it has a hard time adhering to, you know, going to the gym on a regular basis, and they try to find all sorts of ways to trick themselves, and they bounce around from diet to diet, and they try keto for a while, and they do Weight Watchers, that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
And I was reminded, I've mentioned before, of this professor at University of Georgia who was there. I was really looking forward to taking his class on exercise psychology, because he had been for like 20 years the foremost expert on exercise adherence. And he had abandoned that research track because he was finding that while you can impose some behavioral strategies, use sort of a stages of change model. And some of the stuff that you talked about on the podcast with, I'm blanking on her name right now, who I just posted a question about.
Okay.
Denencio.
Yeah.
So, you guys, I didn't get to listen to that because I didn't have that figure. I'm glad you posted that up. But okay. A plug for that. It's like a great podcast from what I listened to.
Oh, yeah. Kate Denencio on Advices Radio, which is obviously also on this station. It was a good show, yes. Man.
Yeah. So, she's working with people who've already sort of gotten to the point where they've got enough kind of oomph to get into exercising. So, this idea of adherence was, hopefully, right? Is that, you know, getting people who maybe aren't going to exercise or in this particular case, he was focused on exercise, but this comes to a lot of health related behaviors. To do that is a very, very difficult thing. You can make some minor shifts in adherence, but on the grand scheme of things, his sort of conclusion that he'd come to is pretty frustrated, you know, after spending like 20 years of his academic career on this, was that we're creatures of immediate gratification. And I've mentioned this before.
Hmm.
So, cultivating a strong mindset is such a difficult thing to do because it's like trying to cultivate internal motivation, which is de facto something that has to come from within.
Yeah.
It's like you can't something that has to have sort of its own starting point. Now you can provide the right external stimuli, but I think ultimately whatever generates someone's drive to really like to obviously go and do something like Tom Platz did. You know, I just heard saw a little clip popped up somewhere online the other day of him from a seminar he did recently where he talked about his mentality when he goes in the gym. About training basically kind of to the death, like winning in that training session. He said he would rather die, literally he would rather die than leave the gym feeling like he didn't give everything he could. So that obviously is extraordinary. That's not how a typically sane person would think about anything.
Right.
You know, they don't see it that way. From my perspective, this is he's asking me, so I guess he's wanted me to sort of dump some of my perspective on things. Is that I have I tend to have sort of a Buddhist perspective on a lot of things, and that the source of our suffering and discomfort and the things that cause us pain in this world are our attachments to things, our attachment to outcomes.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's when you wish something were other than what it is that causes issues of sadness and grief and longing. You want something other than what is. Once you can accept the way things are, then you're fine. And that's very much opposing to the idea of trying to cultivate a strong mindset where you are trying to impose your will upon your body's physiological adaptation. You're trying to create something, and you're putting forth everything within you that you possibly can to do that. One is like totally releasing and letting go and like saying, you know, whatever is, you know, it's okay with me. You know, I'm not attached to it. And the other is I'm going to put all of my cognitive energy into making this happen. This is what, you know, it's a life or death situation for me to make this happen. So those things are, you could think of as being kind of opposing in a certain way. And they are, I think. And for me, then the way that I look at cultivating the mindset, this fits with what I was talking about with us being sort of creatures of immediate gratification, comes down to finding some joy in being the human that I am, in the gym in the way that I do. It's play for me. It's not like, you know, throwing a football in the backyard type of play.
Right.
But it's like, I'm just playing with the things that, you know, all the tools that nature has given me to evoke adaptation in my body. Like, this is a really cool little toy set I've been given. It's a toy set. You know, life is a toy set. This is what Alan Watts is, one of my favorite philosophers. And he, one of his books is You're It, the name of the book. And there's a double meaning to that. And like, you know, it's like the game of tag and you're it, you know? And there's also the meaning like you are it, like you are a wave in the expression of the universe, as an ocean. So you are the wave, you are the ocean, you are the water, you're it, you're the very thing. So when I sort of think about cultivating a strong mindset, I just say, this is just kind of what I was meant to do. This is just being who I am. This is playing the role that I have in the greater scheme of things. And it's fucking fun. I'm going to go have a blast. I'm going to let loose, you know, play the heavy metal or whatever I need to do.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I'm living in this friggin' moment and soaking it up and having a really good time.
That's a great attitude.
Yeah. And so the strong mindset is I think cultivated as, I didn't even know how I was going to answer this question. I had no idea I was going to say anything that I'm saying right now. But
nice.
As paradoxical as it may be, a strong mindset is cultivated not in forcing you to do things you don't want to do. It's finding a way to love the things that you are doing.
Yeah, I get that. I relate to that too.
Yeah, yeah. So, so it's kind of like... all those pieces kind of fit together. So if you want to do it, you're going to do it. If it's, you know, if it's immediate gratifying because you're living in the moment, then you're going to do it. And that's the thing is that, you know, it fits with this kind of Buddhist perspective is if you're enjoying every moment, then that's all there is to enjoy is the moment. So yeah. That you don't have to be attached to whether or not you win the competition or whether or not you get in your best shape, ever. You just realize, well, there I am, and here I am in this very moment, and look what happened. I figured out that, you know, doing this with my diet doesn't work, or trying this in my peak week doesn't work, or, you know, this worked really well. It's all cool. It's all awesome, because then I'm going to enjoy whatever lesson I get out of it, and part of the point is living these lessons.
Yeah.
So the strong mindset is letting go of the outcomes and finding a way to find joy in the moment that you that you're in, which is all you really have. The rest of it's just imagination.
Yeah.
You're remembering the past, and you're guessing about what might happen in the future.
Right.
And all you have is this very second. And it could all end at any time.
Have you ever read the book called The Way of the Peaceful Warrior or seen the movie Peaceful Warrior?
Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite movies.
Oh, me too. I just, I introduced a friend to it the other day, Tommy Styles. He says, he said a lot of things that, that remind me of the things Dan Millman had said in that book. And I totally relate. Just take out the trash, the stuff that doesn't matter, the things that happened and the things that are going to happen. And I try to apply that too, man, and just be there in the moment, not only in that set, but in that rep, like not even thinking about the next set and how if I tax myself too hard on this one, that one's going to be harder. You know, I try to give everything I have to, you know, being where I need to be right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. That's a anyone who hasn't seen that movie, like you really dig it. I think it because it applies to bodybuilding.
Absolutely.
Because it's about being a peaceful warrior. I don't want to ruin any of the bits and pieces of the movie, but it's about interweaving your worldview and your perspective on life with a physical activity, which is kind of what bodybuilding is about.
Yeah.
In ways, you know,
it's available too. I saw it on YouTube. The movie in its entirety is there.
Oh, really? Is it a pirated version? I'm not sure
to tell you the truth.
Yeah, but
I know that they had it released. I know that it's available. You could also, you could rent it easily.
Right.
Get the book.
The book. I think I have the audiobook.
Do you?
As well. Yeah, I definitely have the movie. I actually bought it on DVD years and years ago.
I did too.
Yeah.
I have another one of his books called Body Mind Mastery, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. He talks about the way that we want to be, the way that, I think he compared, he said like the best way to be is, he talked about things that are hard like rocks, but rocks are inflexible, and if you put enough pressure on a rock, it's only going to break versus something like bamboo is hard. But at the same time, if it gets snowed on, the bamboo can bend, it can change. And, it's interesting.
That's from Eastern philosophy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, to tie this back to Tom Platz, just sort of thinking about this is, it actually, now that I sort of put in perspective what we've been talking about here, like Tom was living in the moment in those workouts too.
Sure.
His strong mindset was, the workout is sort of the quintessence of what bodybuilding was about, just being there and being present. And doing and just living in that rep, in that set.
I want to dig back because I saw a movie that he had done one time, and I have only seen it once. It was longer, and I think it was cut into pieces throughout YouTube and stuff. He had said something that really stuck with me. He said, "We are artists, and we express ourselves through our sets and our reps."
Yeah. That squat video where he's got, I think people have inflated it now to 525, but I think it was 500 pounds on the bar. He's got a green belt on.
Yes.
When he had a squat off with Hatfield, I think he does 23 reps in that. That video is really pretty cool because he starts off, you think he's going to get like 8 reps. Looks, he was a little older, by that time he was maybe past his prime. But still, as he does, he still trains like a madman. He lives out in California, and there's videos of him. He still squats really heavy. But watch his face. I've never seen anyone mention this. I've mentioned it a few times, but I don't see people comment on it that often. But if you go back and find that video and you watch his face about rep 12 or so, he gets this smile on his face. He gets like this. It's like this blissful look of, this is where it's at, baby. I'm digging. And he's just grinding those reps out. He's doing a Widowmaker. And even when he gets done, you can tell it's like, it's like he just had an orgasm almost. He's like, oh, that was awesome. Like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, baby. He has this look, he was so happy about what happened. It wasn't like he was just soaking it all in. He was taking it all in.
Yeah.
You see some people train and it's like, oh, this is just awful. I just can't wait till this is over.
Right, right.
And it's like in an uncomfortable way. It's like they look in the face like they're constipated.
Yeah.
Almost like It's like, ah, oh, this is just so uncomfortable. They're not getting aggressive and attacking the set, you know, like in a way that Jordan does, for instance. You know, he goes in there and gets at. He loves that. I read an Instagram post. I think it was Instagram. He talked about. It was just a shot of him standing there a few minutes before he's doing a heavy deadlift. Workout, and he's like he loves that. It's that 2 or 3 minutes before a big set, like that anticipation, like the coming of. Those are his favorite moments.
Yeah.
You know, and people would associate a strong mindset with Jordan, right?
Yeah.
And he's just doing what he loves. Hmm. You know, it's not like he's sitting there and going, oh fuck, I don't want to do this, but I got to come up with some way to make myself do this. Oh Jesus, this is going to suck. This is awful.
Yeah.
But I'm so disciplined that I can get myself to do the things I least like to do. This has been my most hated moment in life. But I'm going to have to do it, you know, so I got to strong. He's like, no, he wants to do it. You know, Platts lived for those crazy squat sets.
He did.
He loved that. So finding love in what you do is as paradoxical as it may seem to do that when it comes to really crazy training is the way to cultivate a strong mindset, I think.
I can see Tom's love for that still in the way he coaches people.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's got so much fire. It's not going anywhere.
Yeah,
yeah.
This is a great way to end the show, Scott.
I think so.
I think I'm pumped, man. I'm actually getting ready to go train now. Tell the truth,
me too.
I have to eat some food. What are you training?
No, upper body today. So unfortunately, not legs, but
nice. I'll be doing another push workout. So this will be my next opportunity to test out the shoulder.
Yeah, that's so cool, man. I'm really happy for you.
Thanks, man. Me too.
Just be careful. Don't get too crazy and, you know, try the 130s or something.
Oh, God, not this time at least. Okay. I'll take my time on that.
Yeah. So, well, good luck, man, and congratulations on that.
Thank you. Guys, for Dr. Scott Stevenson, I'm Scott McNally. For the Advices Radio Network, this has been another episode of Muscle Minds. We will see you soon.
Hasta la vista.
A woman one time said to me that there's sets and there's reps and there's biceps and there's triceps and there's love and there's hate. And every body part is an emotion. And that's the way I train. I'm sort of in the gym. I'm not counting how many times I'm doing something. I'm expressing myself from within. And that's where I come from. It's an emotional experience for me. And I'm very much into feelings. It's more than just sets and reps and numbers. You know, to me, numbers are meaningless. I don't like the only numbers that are really meaningful are the money market numbers and the checking account numbers. Those are the numbers I count. They're my calorie numbers.
Voices Radio.